The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum of Accelerated Government Strategies, which is entirely responsible for its content. Welcome to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum from Accelerated Government Strategies, providing advisory consulting for innovative startups to help grow government revenue. Every week, Aileen and Gigi welcome Washington, D.C.'s most ambitious and influential female executives who are taking risks to engineer success and shape the future. Women of Washington on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now your hosts, Aileen Black and Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
And I'm Gigi Shum.
Today, our guest is Bobby Green Kilberg, president of the Northern Virginia Technology Council. As president and CEO, Ms. Kilberg leads and manages the largest technology council nation with about 1,000 member companies employing 300,000 people. Ms. Kilberg is active in politics and has served and worked in presidential offices to include Richard Nixon, Ford, Bush, and George W. Bush. She's a graduate of Yale University and earned a master's degree from Columbia and a bachelor's degree from Vassar.
Bobby, let's start with your background. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your family life.
I grew up as an only child in New York City, first in Manhattan, and then in Queens, New York, Forest Hills, and then Croton-on-the-Hudson in Westchester County. Had a very normal childhood, I guess. My parents were middle class. My mother was an immigrant. She was a first-generation American from Russia. My father was a second-generation American. He was born in New Jersey. I went to public schools, and then I went to Vassar College and Columbia University and got a law degree from Yale.
So virtually all of the women that we interview on our show have had either some person or some event which served as an inspiration for them growing up or a big influence in their lives. Who or what was your biggest influence?
My parents, very clearly. We were a very close-knit family. We were a small family and very close-knit. We did everything together. If you had to ask me what the one big takeaway would be from my family life, it was a belief in and a value on education, placed on education. We weren't wealthy, but they gave me everything I needed. And they gave me a belief in education, a set of traditional values for my personal life, and a very happy childhood.
So were they educated people themselves, or were they trying to give you something that they hadn't had the opportunity to have in their lives?
Well, no, both. I mean, my father has a master's degree and a bachelor's degree. My mother had an undergraduate degree in accounting, but they didn't have the luxury of having parents who could afford to send them, so they had to work to go to school, and they worked very hard, and they realized that education was the way to improve yourself and your life station. And so they were determined to do it not only for themselves, but also for their child.
Bobby, you had such an amazing career here in Washington, D.C. How did you come to Washington? What was your first job?
Well, we came, my husband and I, we were not married then. We came to Washington as White House Fellows, which was a wonderful program that President Johnson had started in 1964. With John Gardner, who at that point was head of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, not called that anymore. And they believed that they wanted to take young people and bring them into leadership roles in government and then send them back out to the community because they thought there was a disconnect between where young people were and where government was and where business was. They wanted to bring it together. Our class was the class of 69-70. We were the first class where people right out of graduate school could actually participate. And so my husband was a Harvard law graduate and I was a Yale law graduate. And we applied for the fellowship program. And we both amazingly, to ourselves, we were shocked, we both got it. And that's how I got to Washington. I wound up serving in the President Nixon's White House as an assistant to John Ehrlichman, who was head of domestic policy. And my husband wound up as a special assistant to George Shultz at the Labor Department. Most people don't realize that George Shultz was Secretary of Labor before he was head of OMB and Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how we got here.
Wow, that must have been amazing at such a young age to be given such daunting responsibilities. What was it like?
It was scary. And Megan, it was, and you know, if you talk about, I know this is a program on women. And so if you talk about women back then in the early 70s, it was a very, very different world. And to be 23 years old, I went to law school very young, 23, almost 24 years old, and be placed in a White House with a lot of responsibility, just given how the President Nixon's White House operated, was you really stopped a minute and you went, whoa. So it was a great opportunity, but it was also kind of, you realize a lot was on your shoulders. And being a woman in that position where there were not that many women anywhere in government in professional positions was quite a responsibility. President Nixon, by the way, opened up an extraordinary number of positions for women in the White House and was determined to increase the number of women who had responsibility, not just in the White House, but throughout government.
So speaking of, you know, male-dominated environments in those early days, I mean, law school itself was back then, too. And you went to Yale, which, you know, I guess maybe you and your husband have arguments about whether Yale or Harvard is the better law school. But that had to be a relatively tough environment, too. I mean, I imagine you were one of just a few women in your class.
I was. Bill likes to say that he having gone to Harvard, he likes to say he went to law school and I went to Yale. Yale was at that time a very economically and socially versus strict law oriented curriculum. But yes, there were nine of us out of a class of 144, nine women out of a class of 144 men. Seven of us stayed, so seven graduated. And it was wonderful, but also difficult. I mean, it is hard to be that small a minority and that size of a population. And that's true of, you know, African-Americans, Hispanics, others today. Back in those days, the differentiator between the number of women and men was really quite startling. When you talk about women in law school back then, it was a whole different standard. So to gather his class, their class of 144 at Yale, the men had to have obviously strong academic records, but they did not have to go for an interview. The women had to come for an interview. And I will always remember sitting there with Dean Poole. And he sat there across the table from me and he said, okay, why should I give your seat to you rather than to a boy? It was boys and girls. I didn't say men and women. And I said, pardon me? And he said, well, you know, you're just going to sit there, eat up our intellectual capital, and get married, get pregnant, and stay home. And I was just so taken aback, having come from a women's college where women were expected obviously to perform and assert themselves and be confident because you were all women. It just floored me. I did get in and I did come despite that interview, and it was a very good thing. But then it came to time for what are you going to do when you graduate? And I very much wanted to be a White House fellow. And matter of fact, a former fellow who's a classmate of mine was really encouraging me. And I went to Dean Poole again and I asked for a recommendation. He said, no. He said, I'm not going to recommend you because that really needs to be for a young man who's going to move forward in his career. And you're not going to get it because you're a girl, not woman. I did get it, but it was a fascinating mindset.
Did you ever want to go back to look him up now and just maybe hand him a copy of your resume so he can see just exactly what you did with the intellectual capital that they...
Well, I'm so old that I'm afraid he's no longer around. He was in his 50s or 60s back then. But yeah, in some ways I do. But it, you know, when you take a look, I have five children, including three daughters. And when you take a look at their opportunities and their careers, they might face lots of different obstacles, but they're not obstacles like that. They're not obstacles based on what your gender is without other factors being taken into account.
So after you left the White House, you returned to law. You worked for a law firm. Tell us about that time period, because law is definitely a male-dominated environment.
Well, you know, law firms in Washington back in those days, in 1971 to 73, was the only time I was in a law firm. I was at Arnold and Porter, which was a wonderful law firm. I didn't like the practice of law. But I love the people in Arnold and Porter, and I do to this day. They were very anxious to have young women come in as associates, and there were not that many women coming out of law school. So you could never say you were discriminated against in getting a job. They really wanted women in all the law firms in Washington, and they did everything they could to keep me, giving me lots of pro bono. They were a leader in pro bono activity in Washington, giving me lots of pro bono opportunities. I just didn't think over time it was really a fit for me. But they were fabulous. But I did go back to practice, quote, law when I was an associate counsel to President Ford. And I liked that. I loved public policy law. And I loved President Ford. So that was a very nice combination. But the corporate practice didn't really appeal to me.
Well, you kind of made a little turn in your career at that point. You went to Mount Vernon College.
Yes, I did. Again, and that's part of what's wonderful about this town and probably lots of other communities as well. And when I talk to young people, I tell them, you know, take risks, take chances, look for opportunities. You'll be surprised where that next job opportunity will come from. And a person who was on the board of Mount Vernon came to me, a gal's named Jill Ruckelshaus, and we've become very close by being active in Republican women politics and trying to get the Republican Party to be more responsive in many ways to women. And she said, I want you to interview for the academic vice president of Mount Vernon College. And I said, well, I'm a lawyer. She said, yeah, but they don't need an academic. They need someone who has really legal and business understanding and background who can take them to the next level. And so I did. And I did it for 2 years. I would have stayed there for many years. They're now part of GW, on whose board I've served. But Don Rumsfeld asked me to come back to the Ford White House and come back to the White House when President Nixon resigned. And I really felt I should do that for a lot of reasons. I didn't do it until a year later because the academic year had started.
Today, our guest is Bobby Kilberg, president of the Northern Virginia Technology Council. Next, we'll hear about Bobby's early years in her White House administrations. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Bobby Kilberg, president and CEO of the Northern Virginia Technology Council.
Bobby, you mentioned that you went back to the Ford White House, and I want to ask you about that. But before we get there, talk a little bit about what it was like working in the Nixon administration. I mean, when I think of that time, obviously, I think of Watergate.
Well, you know, lots of people do. And I just came back from the opening of the new Nixon Library in Yorba Linda last weekend. And if you go through that library and you take a look and really focus on the accomplishments of Richard Nixon in both the domestic and the foreign policy arena, you have a much better perspective of the whole person. And I mean, I can talk about establishing the Environmental Protection Agency, establishing OSHA, creating Title IX, the first affirmative action plan in Philadelphia in the construction trades, federalism, pension reform, Native American rights, very active school desegregation programs. I can go on and on and on. But that's not what we're here to talk about. You want to talk about women in the Nixon White House. There were very few, initially, professional women in the Nixon White House, as there were very few professional women anywhere in government or in companies at that time. But John Ehrlichman was very determined that I was going to be considered an equal with all the young men. And one of my responsibilities working for him was to take a cabinet department, and mine was the Interior Department. Another focus of mine was to be the assistant staff secretary. That meant that all the papers that went into the president on domestic policy proposals went through me. Not that I had the power to stop them, but I had the power to edit them and to ask questions and to send them back and forth, et cetera, et cetera. And I had an initial problem in that I couldn't get any cabinet members to call me back. And Ehrlichman was just furious. And he says, I don't think they're calling you back because you're a girl. And I said, he didn't say woman, he said girl. I said, maybe. So he went and he wrote a letter. And there's no such thing as emails. He wrote a letter to each cabinet member saying, Bobby Green Kilberg is my White House fellow. She's a member of my staff. She's in charge of X, Y, and Z. And you will take her call. And he then had them delivered. In those days, everything was delivered by messenger. Again, there was no faxes or anything. And then he followed up with some recalcitrant cabinet members with phone calls. And I didn't have any problem after that. So you needed somebody who was your mentor who would really stand up for you and say, hey, you know, I'm going to fix this and I'm going to give you an equal shot. And once I give you a level playing field, you're on your own, but I'm going to give you a level playing field. Next example of that was I was sitting in a senior staff meeting. They were always at 7:30 in the morning. And not because I was a real member of the senior staff, but because as a White House fellow, it was part of my year experience. So I'm sitting there. And President Nixon felt very, very strongly that Native Americans were being discriminated against in the country. And he was determined for a lot of complex reasons to do something about that. And he told Ehrlichman. So Ehrlichman's standing there at the senior staff meeting and saying, okay, who knows anything about, you know, Native American rights? And there was just dead silence. And so I kind of raised my hand a little bit. And he said, you do? And I said, yes. And it was because of a project I'd done at Yale Law School and time I'd spent on the Navajo Reservation. And he said, okay, you're on. And I said, really? He said, yeah, you're the project manager. You know, here I am 3 months out of law school. I am now in charge of a major domestic initiative for the president of the United States. Ehrlichman didn't stop and say, well, you're a woman, but, or, hey, you're young, but. He said, no, go do it because I think you can do it. And so that was a great validation, I think, of the fact that he and President Nixon really looked at people based on their competencies, not on their gender.
Now, when you were asked to come back to the White House under President Ford, uh-huh. by that time, you had already had a couple of years in private law practice, mm-hmm. and you had already had a couple of years
in
education, in academia. So how was that experience different coming to the White House for the second time?
Well, I obviously had a little more personal maturity, and society had moved along a bit, and I didn't have Phil Buchan, who was counsel to the president, didn't need to call the general counsels of the departments and agencies to get my phone call returned. So, there was a difference. There's just a normal progression of time. But it was also a different thing for me, and that I now had a child. We have five children. I now had a little boy, and he was born in March of 1975, and I came back to the Ford White House in July of 1975. So I all of a sudden was faced with, how do you balance family and work? And Gerald Ford was fabulous on that. I mean, he really felt very strongly that, especially since he was in the business of healing the country after Watergate, that family life was very important. And so one Saturday I had to come in. It was on a school busing issue, actually. And I said to Nell, who was the president's secretary, my husband's out of town. I have Jonathan. What do I do? She said, well, bring him along. So I brought Jonathan along. And I have these just fabulous photos of Jonathan. The Roosevelt Room is right opposite the Oval Office, and there's where the meeting was, with Jonathan on the floor with a playmat at 5 or 6 or 7 months old, while the president of the United States and the senior members of the cabinet and me were sitting there having a discussion. And Gerald Ford didn't skip a beat. Jonathan started to cry. President got up, put his binky in the, not his binky, Jonathan's binky in Jonathan's mouth, and went on with the meeting. So, I mean, a White House is what the president makes of it. And his determination was to make it family friendly and also to make it a very place where people felt good about coming to work.
What amazing story.
Yeah, it's funny.
The times that you were in the White House that were very turbulent. What was it like being a White House staffer during the Nixon and the Ford administration when the country, like as you stated, was in a time that needed healing?
Well, I left the Nixon White House in June of 71. The White House Fellows Program was actually a year, but I stayed an extra year as a staff assistant. So I left before Watergate. So I missed most of that. I had friends who were really caught up in it and were terribly hurt by it, including John Ehrlichman, who no longer with us, but remains somebody I think extraordinarily highly of. So I missed it there. In Ford's years, it really wasn't that turbulent either, because he viewed himself as restoring what he viewed as civility to American politics. And he did that very well. We lost the election. We could pontificate about that a lot. But he did what he set out to do, which was bring the country back to a better place than they were psychologically in regard to politics. So, I really wasn't there during turbulent times.
Would you recommend somebody who has political ambitions to join the staff at the White House or be a public servant in the government?
Yes. I think it is an important thing to do if you have an interest in public policy. But I think you need to be careful how you do it. And so I would recommend to a young person to come in, well, the White House is all political, quote unquote, but to come into, if you go into the department or agencies, to come in as an appointee rather than initially coming in as the Federal Civil Service. Because if you come in as an appointee, you might feel yourself to have more freedom to take risks, more freedom to challenge the status quo, because you don't view it as a lifetime career. I think if you ought to look, however, and I think very highly of the Federal Civil Service, I think there's extraordinary people who come in and really are determined that over the span of their career, they are going to make this country a better place. But for young women, I would say come in as an appointee. Or go to the state governments. States are where things are happening. Governors have to govern. Pontificating doesn't do you a lot of good in the states. And so if you really want to see change, come into state government. My youngest daughter was an assistant secretary of technology policy for Governor McDonald for close to 4 years in Virginia. She learned an enormous amount, and she was able to actually do things because state governments are much more flexible and much more open to change and to innovation. And if you want to innovate and make an impact, I think certainly no matter who's president for the next 4 years, a lot of the focus is going to be on states.
Today, our guest is Bobby Kilberg, CEO and president of the Northern Virginia Technology Council. So, Bobby, in 1978, you joined the Aspen Institute as a director of a project on the future of private philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
So yet sort of another career change for you. How and why did you decide to go to the Aspen Institute?
Well, first of all, it really wasn't a career change, and that one consistent thread throughout my career has been interest in public policy. And Aspen was another manifestation of that. This was a project that was actually funded by John D. Rockefeller III just before he was killed in a car crash. And it was to take a look at what directions private philanthropy were going in, and was private philanthropy a vehicle to sometimes substitute for or transplant federal programs? And the conclusion was probably not. But it was a place where you could go. What appealed to me about it was it was a wonderfully intellectually active place. And you could go and create seminars and programming and build relationships among people by bringing them together either at Aspen in Colorado or at Y Plantation in the Eastern Shore of Maryland and discuss. And there wasn't any real requirement that you came up with massive reports. Now you have to do that more than you used to. But then they just wanted to bring people together to connect them and to make them think outside the box about other possibilities, whether there are possibilities in governance, whether there are possibilities in business ethics, whether there are possibilities in philanthropy. So it was a wonderful experience. It also was, by that time, I had two children and I was pregnant with a third. I had been at home after I left the Ford White House for about 18 months, I think, and when we had our second child. And then I really wanted to get back to work, but I wanted something that was manageable. And I thought, well, being at a think tank and thinking would certainly be a little less pressure and a little less stress than what I'd been doing before that. And it was wonderful.
In 1982, you moved from Aspen and became vice president and general counsel of the Roosevelt Center for American Policy Studies. And I read something that there, one of the things that you worked on was a project about management of a high-tech working group that studied the use of information technology in political campaigns.
Yes, it did.
Is that where you got your sort of first interest and taste of high-tech?
Yeah, and that was, you know, early on, and the use of technology, the use of data for voter identification or just how you managed issues was a relatively new field, and it was just fascinating. And actually, eventually that project wound up in a lot of different manifestations at George Washington University in one of their major departments. So it was the first time. I hadn't thought much about that before. And then I went ahead and ran for the state Senate, not the U.S. Senate, the state Senate in Virginia. And I, you know, brought with me a lot of the things that I'd learned from that project.
Today, our guest is Bobby Kilberg, president and CEO of the Northern Virginia Technology Council. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
The Super Bowl TV viewing experience now includes a new technology that offers unlimited angles on the action. For the first time, the Super Bowl broadcast was able to show you replays from the perspective of any player on the field, thanks to 38 high-resolution cameras unobtrusively positioned high in the stadium's rafters.
Think of the field like a big cloud where all the camera views are pointed down there, and you capture all that in three-dimensional space.
The technology called Be the Player was created by Intel. Jeff Hopper of Intel Sports says it allows them to control every square inch of that virtual cloud.
Then take a virtual camera, not a real camera, because they're not on the field or in a helmet or anything like that. And you can now move it in that cloud anywhere you want.
Because the system requires massive computer data crunching, it's not yet instant, but custom replays can be generated in less than 2 minutes. More at nae.edu/radio with the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Bobby Kilberg, CEO, President of Northern Virginia Technology Council. So you went back to the White House and you worked in both Bush administrations. Mm-hmm. So tell me about, you know, that time and the difference between the two.
Well, I did not work for President Bush 43. I was on a council that he had, so that was very different. I did work as an employee for President Bush 41, and he'd also been my mentor for many years, and I kind of viewed him as an adopted father. And when he asked me to come into the White House to be the head of the Office of Public Liaison, which was the office designated to interact with all the interest groups in the country, I looked at him and I said, "You're crazy. I have five children." I then had a little one who was literally just a toddler. I said, how in the world can I possibly do this? And he said, come in and see me. So he was then vice president. So he was in his, still, he was in his vice presidential office. So I came into the old executive office building and sat down with him. And he said, we're going to make this work. I said, how are we going to make this work with five children? He said, it's very simple. He said, let's go over the schedule. I said, okay. First of all, he said, there's senior staff meetings every morning at 7:30 in the morning. I said, yeah. And my kids have to get to school. He said, okay. He said, I'm going to make you the most popular manager in the White House. You can send a staff member to the senior staff meeting. He said, you come, you know, one or two times a week, and then other times you send the staff. And frankly, that doesn't really much matter because nothing happens at the senior staff meeting. What really happens, this was the president talking, he said, or to be president, he said, the real senior staff meeting is at 8 o'clock in my office, in the Oval Office, with John Sununu, chief of staff, and Brent Scowcroft, the head of the National Security Council in the White House. He said, and you're not invited. He said, so you go and you can send somebody else to do that. He said, what else? He checked that off list. I said, well, I kind of like to get my kids in bed some evenings. And he said, well, okay. He said, you know what happens around here after 6:30? I said, what? He said, all the guys get together and they either, you know, have a beer or drink wine and they talk about the day and they stay around till 9, 10 o'clock at night. He said, you're not going to do that. And I said, okay. And he says, what's the deficit of that? I said, well, he said, tell me. I said, well, the deficit of that is that I'm not going to be part of the inner circle. And he said, that's absolutely right. You're not going to be part of the inner circle because you're not going to be there shooting the breeze. But that's okay. You can do your job without being part of the inner circle because they know that I have faith in you. And so he checked that box off and he said, what else? And I said, I really don't want to work on the weekends. And I remember this is before cell phones and there was no internet, public internet. And he said, I'm going to try as hard as I can not to make you come in on weekends. And I only came in on 4 weekends in 4 years. And then he said, check that. He said, anything else? And I said, yes, I really don't want to be away overnight. And he said, okay. And so he arranged so that I would basically go on Air Force One to Peoria, Illinois, and not dumping in Peoria, but Peoria. And my staff would go to California and to Bangkok and to every place else. So I was very popular because I got to send my staff places where I would have loved to gone, but I didn't think I could go with family responsibility. So I, again, over 4 years, probably spent only 4 or 5 nights away from my kids because I had to be somewhere with the president. And I think that's extraordinary. I mean, because you realize when he took office in the White House, he was 67 years old. And for him to think about those things at that time and worry about me blew my mind, made me as loyal to him as I could ever possibly be. And I always loved him and I love him to this day. He just had a quality of a sense of balance and a value of family, which was extraordinary. His son, I like a great deal. I just saw him at dinner maybe 3 weeks ago. I met him at Yale when I was at law school and he was an undergraduate and Yale was going through co-education. We were on a committee to form the basis for co-education together at the university. But I didn't work for him. I was on a council and observing him from the perspective of the President's Council on Science and Technology Policy was very interesting because he really was not a technologist by any means, nor was I, but he really had an interest. And he had an interest in the impact of technology on public policy. And we had some fascinating discussions. And he really, really spent time and energy with that council.
So, Bobby, I'm going to change things around a little bit. I'm going to ask you about your current role in Northern Virginia Technology Council. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do there and the mission?
Well, we are the largest technology council in the nation. We represent the technology industry in this region, predominantly in Northern Virginia, but in Maryland and the District too. We have members from all three jurisdictions. And our role is to grow the technology industry in this region, to enhance our reputation as a global technology center, to work on our workforce needs. Our companies have a very hard time getting the skilled workforce they need, despite all the education programs we have. We are working very hard to improve the ecosystem, particularly between our companies and our universities. Our universities are where innovation is. Our universities are where intellectual property is. Our universities are where the students are. And then we're focusing on three verticals, on cybersecurity, on big data analytics, and health. And we view those as the niche markets where, in particular Northern Virginia, but the entire region, can shine and can really define us as a global technology center. So that is what we're all about, our public policy agenda specifically versus our industry agenda. Not that they're, I mean, they're consistent, but our focus is on state public policy and being sure that Virginia is the best place in the nation to grow and start and maintain a business.
So you can't help but pick up a trade journal talking about the lack of technology skills in our country to meet the growing demand, especially around cyber. So, you know, if we don't start getting more women and minorities into STEM, we're going to have even a bigger problem. It's just a numbers game. So how do you feel we can help improve those numbers?
By the time a young person gets to college, if they've been turned off by STEM, by science, technology, engineering, and math, they're turned off. So you really need to get them at a much earlier age. And we've been working very hard with our school systems to increase the STEM curriculum within the lower schools, i.e. all the way from kindergarten to high school. We also are working very closely with our community college system. We have a fabulous Northern Virginia Community College here. And they, working together with Governor McAuliffe, are putting in very, very strong cyber curriculums, as is George Mason University, as is UVA, as is GW, as is Virginia Tech, obviously. But you need to catch those kids before they get to the community college level. And you need to remember two things. A Bachelor of Science degree or a Bachelor of Arts degree and a Master's degree are very, very important. But there are a lot of STEM fields that you don't need a four-year degree for, that a two-year community college degree combined with a specific cybersecurity or big data analytics certificate is just fine for lots of the work that needs to be done. So you need variety of the levels. The one thing I do want to point out is a kind of a pet peeve that I have that I think a number of people, including David Rubenstein at the Carlyle Group, shares with me, is that STEM is very important, but we must not forget the liberal arts. Because one of the things I've noticed with young people today is you can get very, very bright technical people who cannot write an English sentence, who cannot put together paragraphs and logical reasoning. And unless our young people know and understand our history, our culture, our humanities, our art, where we come from and who we are as a society and as a nation and as a world, it's very hard for them to be as innovative as they should be to bring us to the next stage in our economy and the next stage in our life. And I worry that we're losing that sense of history, that sense of culture, that sense of literature. And that, to me, the ability to have people who can write and logically think and have analytical skills is more important than anything in the world. In fact, I had one of my cyber company CEOs say to me the other day, they would take a liberal arts graduate any day with a strong English and writing and history background over someone who's had a specific computer science skill, and he will teach them what they need to know to be able to deal with his cyber industry.
Today, our guest is Bobby Kilberg, president and CEO of the Northern Virginia Technology Council. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Vivian Williams. Our feet take a lot of wear and tear, which is why problems like athlete's foot, bunions, and nail infections are so common. Family physician Dr. Elizabeth Cozine.
The evidence is not great for oral or topical treatments of fungal infections of the nail. The first thing that I typically recommend is doing nothing.
Bunions, which are a deformity of the bone in the foot, are especially common in women.
Bunions don't have to be treated if you're not having a problem with them. Usually I say get accommodating footwear, so something wide. I wouldn't recommend pointy-toed stiletto high heels to most people.
Dr. Cozine says many of these problems can be avoided with proper foot care.
It's a little bit different if we're talking about somebody with a chronic illness like diabetes, but for the average person, paying attention to what's going on with your nails and your feet, wearing comfortable shoes, and keeping your weight in check.
For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back. You're listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Today, our guest is Bobby Kilberg, CEO and president of Northern Virginia Technology Council. So, Bobby, I got to ask you, you know, Washington, D.C. is all about networking, and networking is key to the success around the Beltway for sure. Networking has been proven key to getting ahead. So these resources are not clear to somebody who's just starting out. Can you help, you know, say what kind of networking resources you'd recommend for a young woman out there just starting out here in the D.C. area?
I think it all depends on the person. I mean, you have to, there's lots of professional associations, there's lots of community-based groups that you get involved in. It depends on what you're interested in. I will tell you one short story. I was at home with our fifth child, and I'd been home for 5 years. And my husband said, you know, you really need to get back out there. People are going to forget who you are. You need to go in the workforce. And I said, well, if they forget who I am, it's my problem. But I agree, I probably should start thinking about what I want to do. And I ran into literally a friend of ours who was a headhunter. And make a long story short, he had me interview for the Northern Virginia Technology Council CEO position. I never sought a job before, and I'd never done a headhunter. And at the end, when it came down to the finals, and I was interviewed by the search committee of the board of directors of NVTC, I looked around the room, and out of the eight people in the room, I knew six of them from being in the community. And I'm not saying that's why they hired me, but I knew them. I knew about them. I knew their families. I knew their interests. And it was because while I was home with our fifth child, with Andrew. I wasn't just sitting in the house. I mean, it was out leading community organizations, being active in other things, being active in our private day school, Potomac School, being active in our temple, being active in a variety of political ways. So be active in what you care about. And if you're active in what you care about, people will notice you and include you in things, and it will come back. You don't do it for that reason. You do it because it's something you enjoy doing, but it'll come back with fruition for you as you look, you know, you look at your next career.
Bobby, you've mentioned several times you have five children, and
yes.
Aileen and I both have four, and I've often said that we usually trump any guest because we
almost have two baseball teams combined.
That's right. We very rarely have a guest who has more children, but you do. And you've talked a little bit about work-life balance in terms of, you know, your time at home and your conversation with then Vice President Bush, but it had to be a struggle. I mean, there weren't even as many good daycare options and things like that when your children were younger. So how did you approach it? What made it all work for you?
Well, you know, I was exceptionally fortunate to have a wonderful spouse. And I think when you have a wonderful spouse, lots of things are possible. And I also had an upper middle class income. And so I had the availability of all sorts of childcare in my home that lots of people don't. I'm very sensitive to the fact that we have lots of single parents. We have lots of lower income people, all of whom are trying to make family and work possible. And it is not easy. So I'm not one to sit there and say, I was able to make it work. Everybody can make it work. It really, really depends on what your economic capabilities and status are, what kind of support system you have. So I'm not a good one to judge, but I've been very fortunate with my children, with my husband, and with the community around us and our neighborhood. I mean, our neighborhood's made all the difference in the world.
Are there times that stick out in your mind where you just thought, oh, I don't really know that I can do both of these things. I feel like I'm being pulled in too many different directions.
Yes. And then you just have to, and that's one of the reasons I decided to stay home with our fifth child. There's an 8-year gap between, we had four kids within 5 years. And then there was, that was interesting. And then we had an 8-year gap. And I decided to stay home for a period of time during Andrew's early childhood for those 5 years, because I just needed to stop. I needed to get off the merry-go-round and say, whoa, hold on now a minute. What do I really want to do with the remainder of my life? And so everybody needs to take a break from time to time. I was economically able to take that break, and I was very blessed by being so, and I realize many people can't. So my advice to people at any stage of their lives, but perhaps to young people too, is that life is short. There are really no redos. Follow your heart, but hopefully don't lose sight of your head. Life is more than work. And you really need to stop and smell the roses if you possibly can. Along with that, you ought to, especially if you're a young person, take some risks. At the same time, balance your life. And you got to know your priorities. You can't be all things to all people. And you have to realize that. And did I create my own glass ceiling in President Bush 41's White House by having, at that point, five kids who were younger? Yes, I did. But is that all right? Would I have traded a single one of those children for anything? No. I am very happy that I made the determinations I did. Could I have gone a little further if I hadn't chosen to have five children? Perhaps. But I never would have done that. To me, my children are my legacy and my husband's legacy. My children are the most important things to me ever. So those are the decisions I make, but other people make other decisions. And whatever you make and decide to do, do it well, but take the risks that enable you to do it well. And don't be afraid. I mean, you know, failure is not a terrible thing. You can pick yourself up and try something again. So you ought to do that. And last point, if I have enough time, is that we do live in an age of technology. And technology enables all of us to work in very different ways than we could work when I first started out. So there are lots of opportunities to have a better work-life balance because you can work at home, because you can always be connected even when you're not in the office. Now, that's a problem sometimes. You need to unconnect and pull the plug every once in a while. But technology gives us all sorts of opportunities in the workforce we didn't have before.
So, Bobby, that's great advice. Have you ever had a mentor?
Yes. I was thinking about that the other day. I've really had three mentors. One was a lady named Pat Connell Shackow, who was the legislative director when I was an intern in the Hill for my godfather, Ken Keating, who is a senator from New York in 1964. She convinced me to go to law school. The second one was President Bush 41. And the third one was John Ehrlichman, all of whom I've talked about. Now, you might say, hey, that's only one woman and two men. Yes, that's right. But I didn't define mentorship by what people's gender was. I defined mentorship with what my relationship was with them and how I felt about them. One thing that Pat Connell said to me that always stuck in my mind was she said, you need to go to law school because you will then stamp that ticket and nobody will be able to consider you a non-professional because you're a lawyer. Today, people look at you and say, what? But back then, in the late 60s and early 70s, women coming out of the best schools in the country were declared to be secretaries. You go up on the Hill and their guys, their classmates, were becoming the legislative aides and the legislative directors, and they were becoming the executive assistants, even if they had master's degrees. If you had a law degree, they could not do that to you. They had to consider you as a professional.
Today, our guest has been Bobby Kilberg, president and CEO of the Northern Virginia Technology Council. I'm Gigi Shum.
I'm Aileen Black.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Women of Washington with Aileen Black and Gigi Shum, founders of Accelerated Government Strategies. Learn more about AGS and the work they do to help accelerate your business plans for public sector at excelgovstrat.com. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Women of Washington, Wednesday afternoons at 1 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You know, the mantra in Washington is follow the money. Everybody says it, hardly anybody does it. But we do, every week on Your Turn with Mike Causey. Whether it's your pay raise, a major change to your retirement package, or the chances of layoffs, we're on it. Because we really do follow the money, and it's your money. Give us a listen Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., or download it anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Your Turn.